Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we've got Jason Ambrose. Jason is the CEO of People AI. Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Christian. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you on. So let's start with People AI. What problem is it solving in the marketplace?
Yeah, so People AI is about delivering answers on what's happening in your sales organization for large enterprises. So what our AI does is it looks at the conversations and the activity that's happening between your customers and your sellers. And it works from that to say, here's what's actually going on, to provide you answers that complement what you see in the numbers, which don't really tell the full story. So we've been around about 9, 10 years. We started a lot on this hard problem of what we call activity capture, and then we've built the AI on top of that. So that's the recent pivot for us. We have customers across the whole spectrum, a lot actually in the AI space. So, you know, OpenAI, NVIDIA, AMD, some others, all the way down to an Iron Mountain.
Awesome. And is there a definition of activity capture that's worth unpacking?
Yeah, so mostly focused on digital. So emails, meeting transcripts, you know, after the COVID era, a lot more sales was taking place in virtual meetings like this one. So there's just a lot more unstructured information that we can draw from. The science behind the AI is figuring out how to match that to, you know, accounts, contacts, opportunities, to use the CRM terminology. So how does it relate to a deal? How does it relate to a person? Right.
So it makes good sense. So, you know, I generally think in terms of objectives. I'm thinking, I'll oversimplify it, but in order for the program to understand what a good outcome is, that has to be, I presume it has to be told.
It has to be trained. So yes. So 9 years, billions of transactions, right? The AI has seen all different flavors of, you know, when a customer says X, Y, or Z, when does that actually mean the deal is on or the deal is off? So you're right. A lot of that is the training around what it's seen before across customers and within customers, right?
So I think this is really valuable to just kind of highlight. So, you know, as I think about different AI infused solutions, you know, there's the technology itself, but then there's just the underlying data set that you're training the LLMs on. And it sounds like a company like People AI has a tremendous advantage because time and grade, and even prior to AI, haven't accumulated what I presume is a pretty large database to draw on.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If we extend from data to context, right? So you can take all your emails, you can dump that into ChatGPT, and it's really not going to be very good at figuring out that information, right? But if you think about pairing that with your structured information of like, what's a transaction, right? Who's a contact that I care about? Who's Verizon? How do I structure and organize who I think about in Verizon? That's where there's a place for firms like us that specialize in understanding very specific types of proprietary information that's sitting within a customer, how to turn that into context and make that available to these reasoning agents that are really generalists, right? So you're absolutely right. I think the space in general is learning the importance and the complementarity of this. You know, what LLMs are good at, not good at. What's the place for vendors like us? And how does that change the way that you think about software and interacting with information, both as humans and agents?
I'm curious, has your focus been on the US exclusively, or you guys sell internationally?
We've been pulled internationally by our customers. So we actually just, we landed a German customer, which we're just starting to roll out. So that's going to be a new experience for us. But predominantly tech, predominantly US. But, you know, as you might guess, as you sell these multinationals, they say, hey, you know, we have sellers in Europe too. So
No, I mean, it makes great sense. You know, one of the things I'd be curious to know is whether or not there are any cultural artifacts that need to be accounted for.
Great question. Yes, I think the context that you build and the patterns that you see do become culturally informed, right? So how settlers work in France or Germany is different. Obviously, we're really sort of on the first edge of learning that, but I think that that's definitely a true pattern. Probably a bigger piece is from a regulatory perspective, right? Obviously, Europe has a lot more concern when you're dealing with works council or whatever else of, hey, if I'm going to take this employee's email and try to create insights out of that, their standard for the care that you take and how you filter, which is an important part of this exercise, is different, right? So you have to be able to understand, hey, when I'm delivering an answer in France, there's a different set of expectations of what I can or cannot look at or what I can or cannot share. Now, filtering has been important to us because if you think about it, the sort of classic tragic slash comic example is, a CRO sends an email to Goldman Sachs and says, hey, I want to move my money around in this account. If you don't have the filtering, you don't know that that's personal because Goldman maybe is a big customer. And if that gets put into CRM, suddenly the CRO's account information and how he's moving money, at Goldman Sachs is showing up in the systems for everybody. So filtering is an important part of that context. We sometimes think about all of the information and building more context versus what do we take out, which is just as important. So back to your cultural question, I think in Europe in particular, there's more sensitivity and thoughtfulness in the design around what do we take out, what can we allow through to the AI.
No, that makes good sense. Okay, so exciting developments with Germany. So as you look ahead, I'd love to, if you know, the degree that you can share, what's the roadmap look like? And then what do you see on the horizon? What are you anticipating in the next couple of years?
Boy, if I could predict it, I'd be making a lot of money because as we can see today, it's Feb 4 and there's a lot of market volatility. I think the market is deciding what kind of risk they want to take in software versus AI, right? And I think that's a signal to all of us that there's a lot of change coming in the next couple of years. What I think our how I think about our place in that is we know this is a hard problem to solve. We know that this needs to be solved. We need to know the boundaries of like what we need to be really good at versus, what Claude is going to go solve or ChatGPT is going to go solve. And I think we have a clear sense that this idea of generating answers that are actionable, which to us means, it's one thing to say we need to build relationships with stakeholders. Who cares what do you do with that? Or this deal has a 63% chance to close. What's the difference if it's 63 or 68? To us, it's, hey, you're stuck with this stakeholder who has these concerns. Here's the way that you need to answer that. You need to bring in these examples from other customers. You need to involve this person in the organization who help addresses this issue. That's an actionable answer to us. That's hard work. There's a lot for us to do to be better at that, and find our place in a world where we don't care if it's humans or agents who are asking the questions that we deliver these answers to and where they ask those questions, right? So it may be in our software experience, it may be through ChatGPT itself, it may be in another system. So our 2 years is going to be about really being phenomenal at generating these answers and finding our place as customers and the landscape changes where they decide how much they want to build versus buy, how much they want humans to do, how much they want agents to do.
It makes good sense. As I'm listening to you, I feel like this trend towards specialization is going to continue to increase
I think it
because.
has to. I think let's take three premises of like how you show up with software, right? The first is, sort of this generalist interface, which the big guys are owning. And that's just a huge amount of capital to be able to do the LLMs and have that first experience. That's OpenAI, that's Anthropic, Microsoft maybe has a play in that, Google, right? I think we know that the world is going to anchor around that. The next questions are, software versus AI, and where does that sit, right? SaaS platforms, ones that essentially manage business workflows, they're really going to have to figure out who they are and what they do in this world when a chain of thought reasoning agent can work through workflow questions of what should I go do? Back to your point around data, the piece that's missing and where we think that specialization shows up is how we present that information to this layer that's contextualized, that so that it's useful to it and it's accurate. And that's the specialization that I think there's a place for. The world of I'm going to take an LLM, I'm going to wrap it around some particular workflow or use case and think that builds a business. I mean, we've pretty much seen in the market that there's not a lot of belief in that.
I agree. Yeah, no, 100% agree, and I think your assessment's spot on. I think the implications are you have to answer your question, what's your USP? And in the case of People AI, it's your cumulative experience as as
Yeah,
using your
across
data set.
customers, across sales, like just, I like to say, look, you can't go back in time and learn the last 9 years from a
That's right.
market perspective, right?
And there's that element. And I think the other part too is I was reading some stats on just quality of coding using just vibe coding tools. And it's still not there. Not to say it won't improve, but I think if you couple that with anyone who's run a software company, maintaining software is a full-time job. Customer success is a full-time job. I mean, there are all these elements that you have to build around a business in order to monetize a solution that I don't think you can just, at least today, delegate to an agent and say, hey, I know you have this. I mean, you're going to have oversight. I don't think there's any escaping it.
I totally agree. I think it's a long time before human in the loop goes away. I think maybe there are some edge cases where this works. What we experience is the more you get to into these larger customers and you go to deeper and more important solutions, it's hard. Like there's just a lot of nuance to it, and there's a lot of work to make it work for that customer. What Iron Mountain wants is what Iron Mountain wants. It's very specific to them, right? How that compares to an NVIDIA, very different, even though we might say the underlying technology is doing the same things. So I think there is still a very personal effort, not just in the coding, but in the presentation of these as solutions that solve business challenges for customers, that when you take all of that together, I mean, AI is going to help. It's going to give us some acceleration, but I agree with you. You see this content like, oh, I built a SaaS company in, 3 hours with four prompts. Like that's just not going to make it in a place like Red Hat.
No, I agree. Yeah, I mean, I think the trend is clear. Anyone who's factoring customization and personalization is on the right track. Now it's the question of, what problem are you solving? If we take a step back, I'd love to, learn more about your career progression and how it led up to People AI.
Yeah, I was reflecting on this as we got on this podcast. I have a really strange journey because it's taken a lot of twists and turns. And I'll go all the way back to college just because I think I always reflect on this as an interesting decision point. So I was studying psychology at Stanford, and I thought I would be a clinical psychologist of all things. And somewhere in the middle of that, I had a friend who was getting married in San Diego, and I had some friends who were still on campus. I was living in LA at the time, back at home, and they rode a trip down and they picked me up, and on the way back they said, hey, you should just come back to campus early and spend the summer with us up there. And I said, I don't have a place. One of them said, hey, I'm managing a dorm, I'll give you a room there. And another, I said, I don't have a job. And another friend said, hey, I'm working at the med school. I can get you a job there. You're good with computers, right? Okay. So packed up my stuff, went up. That job
You
was.
should have said I didn't have a girlfriend either, and they wouldn't.
I know. I should have run the table. So that job was building TCP/IP networks for the med school, and this was before the web. So it was like a really nerdy technical job. I was running around stringing cable and all this other stuff. And then 95, Mosaic comes out. I remember downloading the alpha, and I thought, wow, this is going to change everything. And within a year, suddenly this was a whole new space and market and opportunity. So that was a big fork in the road for me to get into tech. And then along the way in that journey, some entrepreneurial phases, I found my way into more of the business side, but off of this, technology foundation, which, it's wild to me to be old enough that there are people who are, fully formed and grown as humans who didn't live through that part of the experience of when the internet was a new thing and we were trying to figure it out. Which I see a lot of parallels to AI, but I didn't follow the, go to McKinsey, which I did work at for a period of time, work your way up through the ranks, go through graduate school or whatever else. It was sort of a meandering course to get to where I am today. Even this job, I started working with Oleg, our founder, on, strategy, and we were just working through what do we do with this business because I had a lot of experience with CRM, and that just became a natural discussion and progression as he had this amazing opportunity to go work with the Ukrainian government. He said, "Hey, do you want to come run this business?" So, I think the theme to highlight for me has been I always made choices based on what I thought would be an interesting mission or problem to go solve versus a build a career and try to be a CEO. So I don't know how valuable that is to the audience, but at least knowing that sometimes you can have a journey like this that you would look on paper and say it doesn't really make sense how it all flowed through, but to me it did at the time.
Yeah, I don't I mean, I don't know that there's obviously there's some paths to get to CEO, being an investment analyst on Wall Street and get your
Yeah,
money
exactly.
and at Wharton and then climb the ladder. But my experience has been is when you get exposed to a lot of different things, it just changes your worldview and makes you that much more effective of a manager. And then it just, in terms of scope.
I
So
agree. I think what's interesting about career progressions is, especially if you work in big companies, is, you sort of have this mission and you work within the machinery of your function, but it's kind of a closed loop system. And then at some point, and you're just getting better at selling, you're learning more things about selling to take that as a function, but pick your function, right? But then there's this transition when you're in senior leadership. Now you're market facing, you're looking across all of these things, and you're not working within the controlled walls of like what you're expected to do in the function and the organization. Now you're facing contact with the market, and it's a very different mental skill set of I don't know what's happening out there. I have to see what's happening, perceive, and translate into what do we need to go do with the business. And to your point on diverse experiences, I think that that's just helpful for people to be build a better set of problem-solving skills, have a better base set of experiences to then apply in that situation.
yes, I think it definitely informs pattern recognition because then you,
Yeah.
and in creativity because then you see solutions to problems that you might not have just given parallels. I'm curious, so what were some of the biggest takeaways, positive or negative, around product development, sales and marketing, or just running a business that really stuck with you over the years?
It's going to sound kind of trite, but listening and focusing on what the customer wants, like it just has a way of piercing through everything. And when I see organizations or have been in organizations or have faced challenges where we lost sight of that, like that's really where we got into trouble. And I think that's an easy thing to say. So it's so what does that really mean? I can tell when I'm not following that pattern, when my head is spinning on things that I want to get out of a conversation with a customer, or I want to move them from A to B, as opposed to just being open and saying, okay, let me really hear and absorb first what's important to them, and then go decide what to do and act on that, right? So to me, I think it's that lesson of that mindset, whether it's that or whether it's speaking to investors or whether it's speaking to partners, of just really truly starting with listening and saying, okay, they're going to tell me the things that I need to react to based on what I want versus and listening for things to try to get this conversation to a place that I want.
My experience been is that most people's listening skills are poor. And
Yeah.
I don't know if that's out of ignorance or contempt. What's your sense?
Wow. Probably all of the above, right? I think exactly to your point, like, and what I was just saying, like, what makes for a good listener, right? When I think when your brain is running on the things that you care about, right? And you're not really processing what they're saying with that mindset shift of what is it that's important to Christian, right? Why is he telling me these things? Start there and then say, okay, so now what does that mean for me? When it's Christian is not saying the things that I want, so how do I get him to say the things that I want? Like that to me is poor listening.
You know, it's interesting as I was listening to you.
Right? See, there you go.
I think you may have just m explained why. So, you know, people say you got to give to get. You may have just
Yeah.
explained why you get when you give, because the starting point is really empathy.
Yes.
If you're in that mindset, then you're not thinking about what you're getting. You're just saying, hey, what's important to this person I'm interacting with? And then I presume what happens is you just, you know, I find there's cause and effect. It seems like your odds are maybe higher you'll interact with someone who gives you back what you're giving them.
Yeah, and it ties to the trust equation, which I don't know if you've heard of, but
What is it?
I think this came out of McKinsey, but this was really insightful to me, is this idea that we base trust on sort of four factors, right? And it's the numerator is the sum of clarity, like can you speak clearly about, you know, what you believe or what goes on, intimacy of do I really know you or do I feel like there's a connection, and reliability, which is do you do what you say you're gonna do, right? That's all divided by self-interest. So if I perceive that you're acting out of self-interest, it doesn't matter how reliable you are or how close we feel, it just gets massively diluted out when I think you're acting in your own interests. And that's been interesting to me as I work through this transition, because it's probably something that was instinctive to me, but I realized it's true and it works when you think about how do you make that connection and what makes for good listening. Exactly to your point is like, hey, if I'm listening and it feels like we're having this conversation in my self-interest versus your interest, you're going to approach the conversation differently, right?
Yeah. No, that's, I mean, I like the formula. I may borrow it.
Yeah, it's not even mine. It's out on Google, so.
Duly noted, we'll give credit to McKinsey, but yeah, shrink the denominator, or maximize the numerator, or both.
And, well, and the point is, like, you know, you can work really hard at the three, but if you're not working at the bottom one, it really dilutes out. So self-interest is super important when it comes to that empathy, right?
Yeah, you know, I agree, but I tell you, it's interesting. One of the things that comes to mind, though, is I wonder if you buy credibility by being sincere and saying, hey, I also am doing this to make it a win-win, meaning I have a degree
Yeah.
of interest involved in what we're doing. Yeah, I guess as I'm listening to myself, it sounds transactional. And this has been a big topic, not only in this podcast, but just, you know, in our day to day. But you know, one of the things that we see, or our opinion of what we think is happening with AI, is it's reinforcing personal relationships.
Yes. Yeah, look, I think you won't get the denominator to zero, right? Everybody does have self-interest, right? I think you could probably not to force the formula, but you know, I do like to understand like where you stand
Yeah.
when we're having this conversation, but you know, maybe that fits in the clarity. But I think there's sort of like the on the table understanding, and then there's the like, okay, selling is the perfect example of this, right?
Yeah.
When you talk to a seller who's just clearly transactional, who's really trying to force a deal, like the trust just isn't there from a buyer's perspective to give them information and work with them, right? The difference to me between a great seller who listens and builds that trust is they're also working towards the goals that are going to make that buyer successful by making this purchase, right?
Yeah.
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 So
You
I
have
think that's part of what you're hinting at is like, look, yes, I mean, we're in a discussion where there's something in it for both of us, but like, let's be clear about that. And my job is to lean more forward into how do I help you with your side of it, right?
I think you're spot on. And I tell you the things that come to mind as I'm listening to you. It's one, I think it's the belief in the seller as to the utility of what they have to offer. If they
Yeah.
genuinely believe that there's something of value there, odds are more likely you'll act in confidence. Because even if things don't work out with that sale, odds are high they'll do in the second one. And so I think the second part, then I'll tell you, the CEO and me just goes, well, damn, just make sure your pipeline's really big too.
Yeah, we were having this discussion internally. I was telling people I worked in 15 years in CRM and sales excellence. I don't think I had a single client over hundreds of situations that said, "Oh my God, we've got way too much pipeline."
That's
Like,
right.
so
Great problem.
yes, always more, right?
Yes. Okay, so let's come back to the client. And
Yeah.
so is there any kind of in the weeds tactics you've accumulated or really a go-to over the years that you find assist increase the numerator?
I think the biggest is clarity and reliability in the sense that you can't hide the truth, right? So if something is not going well, the customer knows it, right? So, or investors, right? This is the same thing I've seen on this side of the room. It's kind of, it's really in some ways the same relationship, right? They've given you money for a set of outcomes that they want to see from you, right? So you lose that trust because whether it's self-interest or pick your letter, when you start to try to spin or tell a story that's different from what they feel or know, that's where the trust erodes quickly. And they really focus on that reliability of, can I trust you to get through this situation? And in most cases, they're it's temporary, it's transitory. You got to work through it together. Whether it's in a deal cycle or an implementation or something else, these projects always have their ups and downs. And look, if you have experienced people on the customer side, they know that too, right? They're trying to work through this issue. So be forthright, just say, hey, look, we understand that here's the problem that we've got to work through. Own your piece of it and get to clarity on here's what we need to do together to work through that.
I would love to know your opinion as to whether or not you subscribe to the customer's always right.
That's almost a trap question, but I totally agree with the provocative nature of the question, and it's something that we should evaluate. I think the customer is always right about success for them and what they want. They may not be right on how to get there or the situation that's preventing us from getting there.
Okay.
So, let's take an implementation, right? The customer says, look, we have to get live by this period of time and we have to show these results for sellers. Like, that's right. Can't challenge that. That's always going to be right. But they may say, look, you need to do these features or else we can't be successful and we can't roll it out to customers. That may not be right. And so then you have to have a conversation of saying, okay, well, let's understand what it takes for your stakeholders to be happy with this implementation. And then let's work through whether or not the things you're asking for are important to that and to that community. And that may be the course that says, okay, maybe there's a different path to get to the outcome that you want versus what you think is the path to get there. It feels like some parsing, but I think it's really important because,
Oh, 100%.
yeah,
Yeah.
that's the it, like, because I do think about what does that statement mean? What is it really trying to tell us? And to me, the takeaway is like, look, it's trying to say when the customer says this is what they need to be happy, that for sure is true.
It's an edge, well, maybe it's not an edge case, but I'd be curious what counsel you have for the founders in the audience of how to resolve an implementation where the client is obtuse and you know you're the best solution for them and that their project will absolutely benefit from the solutions that you provide.
This is probably one of the hardest things with being a founder and a differentiating characteristic. So, I've been a founder and won't get into all of it, but they haven't been successful. But part of my learnings in those journey is the most difficult thing about being a founder is you have all this pressure to have progress, to do these things, and you're just looking for a signal to grab onto, right? And sometimes that's a customer, even a major customer. And in that situation that you're describing, you have to prepare yourself for there's a line that that customer crosses where you say, this just isn't worth it for what I'm trying to do with the business. And you have to be able to say no with conviction, right? No with a, this might be the end of this relationship and conversation. If you can get to a place to do that, it's important to draw the line. But when you are across that line, you need to be able to do that, because if you can't do that reset with that customer prospect, you don't know the point of the opportunity cost to say it's just not worth it anymore in this situation, and should we walk away from this? That's really hard as a founder, because you get the momentum, you've done all this work, you finally get a signal, you finally got into this conversation, you finally got this customer, and you think, God, I have to make this work no matter what. And the answer is you don't, right?
A ton of great insights up until this point, and I think you just made this episode in itself gold with that counsel. I wholeheartedly endorse your position. I think it's just really good business. Maybe selfishly for, our company, even if we know we're the best solution, but
Yeah.
I agree. I think at some point there's the ROI goes negative. If even subjectively, if you can't like see eye to eye.
Yeah. And sometimes that's the reset that's needed, right? Is then it causes that customer to step back and say, whoa, okay, right? And look, I think being honest with yourself of, are they seeing value in this, right? Because if they see value, then they should be committed to understanding, that they've got to work with you, right? If they don't, if they think they're just gonna, sort of beat you up and lead you around, again, is that the right thing? Is that the healthy thing? Now, that's easy to say here on a podcast, right? When you're facing that moment, that's one of the hardest things about being a founder, right?
100%. Any experiences that you wouldn't revisit under any circumstances or touch with a 10-foot pole?
Probably bad bosses. It's always like I don't have the best personalities for sort of fitting in autocratic, make your boss successful situations. But I think, when I've seen and understood, hey, they're not really in it for me. They don't really, it's not a mutual relationship. Sticking with it just never worked out, right? That's probably the biggest one that I would say, to myself looking back, hey, you knew in these situations it wasn't going to work out, move faster on that, right?
So, I would love to know then how you think about forming culture and staff development, given you're in charge and you
Yeah.
guide the direction of the company.
Yeah. It's, I think there's a nature versus nurture question to this too. I think a lot of organizations, they just, it naturally springs forth of like, what, how do people work? What's the vibe? You do have to riff off of that. I think when you think about setting a culture, but I think the biggest thing is showing up by example of just whatever you want to frame as the culture, right? Without, sort of passing judgment on what's better or worse. It needs to show up in your actions, right? It doesn't show up, I try to do weekly posts on Slack in my channel about, hey, here's what's going on or what I'm experiencing. It's not going to show up there, right? It's going to show up in the calls for what do we do with this customer situation? What do we do with this part of the plan? What are the choices that we make? And not in the business choices necessarily, but just how you show up around the edges of that, right? And I think people key off of that, thinking about when you see the type of behavior that you want to form the culture. Do you take a moment to acknowledge it and appreciate it when somebody does that? When you see it's something that you need to correct, do you pause and stop to talk about that versus just, getting through the meeting or running on through the day? So showing that it's important to you to think about and work with people, that you're paying attention to it, and but also demonstrating it, I think that those are, to me, the biggest elements that drive a culture versus a sort of top-down prescriptive stone tablets. This is what our culture is about. Like, it's just got to be real and people have got to experience it, right?
How quick are you to let somebody go, and do you and how does that play a part into team dynamic?
Yeah, boy. I think the hardest thing, especially at this level, is you always have this feeling of got to move faster, right? We've got to make change happen faster. We've got to do things faster. But these are real people, right? And I think you have to carry that inside to say not just what's right for the business, but what's the right way to handle this situation? Like, how much was on us versus them, right? Like if you've given people the markers and you said this is what we need out of the job and they're not getting through, move quickly, right? It's not working. Let's not go through the theater of saying, like, we're gonna do a performance plan when it's not gonna work. Just give them the time and say, look, the best thing for you is to find your next thing, right? But somewhere in between that and some other situations is, how much of this is on us? Could this person be successful in a different role? Were they really just not being set up to succeed? You have to at least stop and ask yourself those questions. And sometimes it's like, look, it's a nice person. They're trying, just doesn't fit culturally, right? I think finding a graceful exit and taking a little bit of risk of what it means to try to work through that. Versus the, like, how do we run this as an HR process and, do the cold cut? To me is important, but, I think what's hard if you haven't sitting in this chair is to understand that that's really hard to do sometimes, right? Back to the question, I think it's more that I try to think about what do I need to learn and see and understand to know that it's the right time, right? And how do I move through that quickly, right? Whether it's a week, whether it's 8 weeks, that's as much as I can, I try to live by that, right?
It's a great answer. What I heard was circumstances matter. If we're going to be empathetic with our clients, we're going to be empathetic with our staff and really, seek to understand, and if there's a potential to make it work, great. If not, hey, let's just be direct and, provide clarity as to what's going on. So, I see we're near the top of the hour. I
Well,
think
that went fast.
it went quick. I think I may have heard this, but I'm just gonna ask to be sure. But I love doing retrospectives, and so I'm gonna ask you if you had a chance, go back and have a conversation with yourself again when you're at Stanford or high school or earlier?
Yeah.
What would it look like?
Yeah, I think the biggest piece would be to understand, like, I think not being passive about a situation, right? You don't have to accept the circumstances. This is me talking to young Jason. Go do something about it, right? Even if it's make a change to change the situation and the circumstances. I think I let some things ride too long, which is interesting for me to say because I've done a lot of different things over different periods of time. But having a bit more confidence and a sense of, hey, go change that situation, give it a shot, see if it works. And if it doesn't, well, you knew it wasn't working anyway in the first place, whether that's a place of employment, political issues, customer dynamics, market dynamics, whatever else, right?
When you were that age, do you think that was just not knowing, or do you think there was a fear element to it as well? Not understanding the potential outcome.
I think a big part is not knowing, but I do think, for me at least, the idea of failure or rejection, when you're younger is scarier than when you're older. And it's like once you get older, you understand, look, it's pretty unavoidable. Like you're gonna have some failures in life. Like it's not all gonna go swimmingly. And once you're through those and you understand, hey, look, it happens. Like it's not great, but it happens. Then I think that's the benefit of age and probably what we call wisdom is knowing, look, these things are gonna happen. It should not deter you from making decisions or charting courses where you might fail, you fix it on the other side. The biggest thing is make those decisions, right?
Hey, everybody in the audience who's starting their career, I take heed. I agree. I think you're spot on. Jason, love to give you an opportunity to recognize anyone personally, professionally, who's had a material impact on you over the years.
Well, so I'll give a shout out to my friend and probably my only mentor really is a fellow by the name of Doug Smith, who known for many, many years, but he was a founder at Anaplan. Just a great human, taught me about authenticity, taught me a lot about business world, and always love chatting with him. He's always been available and helpful throughout the years. I do want to shout out my team right now because I'm really happy with this leadership team. Natalie, I've known for years. We worked together at Anaplan, but the rest of the team, we just formed in the last couple of months, and it's just been a great dynamic, very energizing for me. So, love you guys. Love to continue working with you.
Fantastic. I have a feeling, I may be wrong, that mentors are underrated. Did you seek out Doug? Was it serendipitous? How'd you end up?
It was serendipitous, and I wasn't really. Maybe this is partly from being an only child. Like I just tried to figure, and being an early founder, I always felt like I had to figure stuff out myself. So I didn't really think about the idea of like a mentor can help you through this process, right? And it wasn't until later years that I understood the value in that and looked to that with him in particular. So I guess that back to your question, that would be another thing is like, hey, you don't have to go this alone, especially in the young years. Mentorship can really help with that. And understanding now, being on this side of life, the value and the benefits of trying to mentor people. So that's another point of feedback for especially for younger folks in the audience, is it's okay and people would love to help you, and there's a lot that they can have to offer, right?
Agreed. You got me thinking now about being an only child. It's interesting. I never connected those dots before. It gave me something to think about after this podcast. And what's the implication too? Interesting.
Yeah, I also didn't really think about it too much, because when you're growing up, it's just like this is the way it is, right? I didn't have a frame of reference of what it would be to have siblings, and people who have siblings don't know what it means to be an only child. But over the years, you have different people tell you like, oh, that's because you're an only child, which at some point didn't make any sense, but then I got to a point of saying, like, yeah, it's a different experience. I can see that now, and maybe that does change some things.
Jason, really appreciate your time. This was great. I think there's a tremendous amount of knowledge and experience that came out. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
If there's anyone listening who wants to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Yeah, come, you'll see me on LinkedIn. That's probably the best place, in a couple other socials, but come find me there. You can find out about us on our website, but hit me up on LinkedIn if you want to chat some more.
Awesome. Again, Jason, thank you. Again, for benefit of our audience, Jason Ambrose, CEO of People AI. Appreciate your time.
Sounds good. Thanks, Christian.
Pleasure. All right. Thank you for joining us. Another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.